Break the silence. I'd like to call the first meeting of the Higher Education Finance Committee to order. And as we begin, I think all the other committees that serve on have probably gone through the same process of introductions. So we're going to do the same here this morning. So we are going to do that, I think, right off the bat, and then we'll talk about some other things pertaining to this committee. So let's begin. Brian, you want to begin down there? And you can say anything you'd like about anything as far as maybe it pertains to higher education, maybe not, just so we get to know you a little better.
Sure. Again, my name is Brian Danish. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I represent District 24B in Faribault and south of Faribault, Steele County, Rice County, and Dodge County. I'm a freshman, first time being in a role like this. And My college started at age 19. I took over my family's business at age 19, and so I never did go to a four-year or five-year college. I kind of got the school of hard knocks, I guess. It was a good experience for me. I don't recommend it for everybody, but it was a good experience for me, and I'm anxious to serve on the committee and help. We've got four children, all graduated from college now. My youngest one just graduated last week. He's in 5 years at Stout in Wisconsin, and so all four of my children have graduated with their degrees. And I'm just very excited to be a part of this.
Okay, thank you. Bob, I think you're next.
Sure. Hi, everyone. I'm State Representative Bob Barrett, third term, first term on higher ed. Very excited to be on the committee. I'm a graduate of Harvard, the Harvard of the Midwest, which is affectionately known as Mankato State University. Graduated in 89 and came over from South Dakota. For a couple good reasons. One, I wanted to get out of South Dakota, but two is inexpensive, good quality education. I got an accounting degree from them, and I'm a proud graduate. I have two daughters, both in college, one out of state, University of Wyoming, and the other one is kind of between colleges right now, maybe coming back. She went to Northern Iowa for a while, but now possibly coming back maybe to a Minnesota college. So I'm interested in college, higher ed, from many perspectives. Certainly tuition is a big part of being able to attend a college or not. So interested in how much we charge our kids for tuition. And just happy to be here and soak in all the good ideas the committee members here will have.
Joe.
Chairman, thank you. I'm Joe McDonald. My first term here on higher ed. Quite excited to be here with you, Chairman, and Chairman Pelosky. I have heard some great things about this committee and the responsibility that it has in pursuing and continuing the great education that we have here in Minnesota. I'm from Wright County, and this is a third term. I have a commercial photography studio in the city of Delano and a family with three boys. One who just graduated from the University of St. John's University and is now, thank the good Lord, working. So I have two more younger ones that will go, one in third grade and one in the ninth grade. So thank you for allowing me to introduce myself.
Okay. Drew, I think you're up.
I'm Drew Christensen. I represent 56A Savage in Northwest Burnsville. You know, I'm actually a current student at the University of Minnesota Twin Cities, so I think I bring a unique perspective to this committee, and I'm excited to work with everyone to make higher education better in the state of Minnesota.
Yes, Cindy Pugh, and I represent 33B, Chanhassen in the area around Lake Minnetonka. I am a University of Wisconsin-Madison graduate. Met my husband. We went to school there together and graduated. We have two adult children, one who graduated from Metro State and is gainfully employed in Chicago, and our daughter is a graduate of Miami University in Ohio. So that's been a really very interesting experience as well. And I also have completed the Fast Track program through the Center for Entrepreneurship at the University of St. Thomas. I'm excited to be on higher ed. It's my first time.
Thank you. Abigail?
Hi, I'm Abigail Whalen. I represent Anoka and Ramsey District 35A, and excited to be here on higher ed. I recently graduated from the U of M and the Humphrey School of Public Affairs, and looking forward to working with you all and improving higher ed in the state.
And our Vice Chair, Marion.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. Marion O'Neill. I serve Buffalo, Monticello, Maple Lake, the other part of Wright County. Nice to have Joe here. I don't think we've served in a committee together before, so that's kind of fun. And also, I have my brother at the end, so that's even more fun. And I'm the first one to go to college from our family of six. So he had to work it out in the family business, and I was fortunate enough to actually go to Bemidji State. So my bachelor's degree is from Bemidji State in applied psychology with a minor in chemical dependency. And my master's degree is from Regent University out on the East Coast in Virginia Beach. And that's in family and marital counseling. And I have my son, my daughter-in-law, and my daughter all in college at the same time at the same university. My son recently got married over the interim, and so we've got that whole new dynamic of having a son and a daughter-in-law, and my daughter now all at college. And my daughter's actually doing PSEO, so I've got that two kids in college plus PSEO students, so I've got that perspective as well. And I have a sister that's even younger that just got her PhD, so now I'm like, oh, now I got to get a PhD. So maybe that'll be my next endeavor.
I think we'll go back on to the end. Josh, you want to grab a mic?
Yeah, sure. My name is Josh Heinzman. I represent the Brainerd Lakes area. That's House District 10A. My wife and I have five kids. We run a little business in Nisswa. And I was fortunate enough to utilize the PSEO option myself, and so I got my degree and went to work in the family business, as I mentioned, and I'm thankful for the opportunity to serve. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
It sounds odd when you say 10A, because I represented 10A for about 10 years before the last redistricting. So, Glenn.
Yeah, I'm State Rep Glenn Grunhagen. I represent McLeod and Sibley County, which is west of Minneapolis on Highway 212. I served on higher ed last year and last biennium, and I was very impressed with the leadership Representative or Chair Pawlowski gave in the accountability reform. I think there's a lot of change coming to higher ed, and look forward to working on a bipartisan basis to address that. I've owned an independent insurance agency that I started from scratch, took a lot of scratching. And I still scratching at times, but I sold health insurance for over 35 years. There's three things I don't really like. It's Obamacare, Obamacare, and Obamacare.
You have an opinion? I'm sorry. We'll probably get to these other staff here in a little bit, but since we're going this way, I will just introduce myself. I'm Bud Nornes. I've represented half of Otter Tail County for the last 18 years, and proud to be from that part of rural Minnesota. Three kids, and our experience with higher education has been with our three kids and now with our grandkids, but they all chose different paths. One went to the University of Minnesota, one went to St. Cloud, one went to Staples. Now I've got grandkids scattered from California to Boston to Arizona and Colorado and Minnesota. So it gets harder, but they've all chosen independent paths in this life. And one is at the Berklee School of Music in Boston, and a couple of them are out of private schools in California. One is at a snowboarding school in Colorado. One is at a soccer school in Arizona. So there's, you know, you got to find a passion in life, I guess, and that's good. Whether it leads to, you know, a livelihood. One has a goal of being in the Olympics. And if he's successful, I don't know if that leads to, again, a livelihood. But we'll see how that goes. So anyway, my wife and I have been married 52 years, and very, very happy to be here. And very happy to live in Minnesota. And very proud of all of the institutions of higher learning. Minnesota is really blessed, I think, to have the opportunities that we do have for the young people that are looking for the education and opportunity to stay here and make a living. So, Gene, would you do the honors?
Yeah, Gene Pawlowski. I represent primarily Winona County, Winona City, Lewiston. I have St. Mary's University, Southeastern Technical College, and Winona State University. Winona State is the oldest university of its type west of the Mississippi and the first teacher university west of the Mississippi. It was the first land grant. And Representative McDonald, I served on the Education Committee when Bob McCarron was chair. Your father was on the committee. That's exactly where he sat.
Is that right?
So there must be something in the genes on multiple levels.
Thank you.
Kim?
Hello. I represent Rochester, Minnesota. I have, like some of the rest of you, multiple institutions in my district. We have private schools. We have two-year, four-year, and a university branch all in Rochester. So I'm interested on all levels. I, as many of the rest of you, I have five children, and they have done public, private, in-state, and out-of-state. So I've experienced all those as well. I've been a member of this committee since I came here 9 years ago and look forward to continuing to work on the issues that are important to our students and our families and our economy. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for being here. I hope you don't mind me calling you by your first names today, but we're going to be kind of informal occasionally. Ben?
And, Mr. Chair, I would like to just say I am not going to apologize, but I am a Cornhusker rather than a Gopher. So, but we're all in the Big Ten now, so we all play in the same sandbox.
All right, and then some people are, I suppose, in a way, you can't root for those NDSU Bison, can you?
I'm more of a Vikings fan at heart, so.
Or a Cobber?
No. Dragons, go Dragons.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
All right.
No, thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Ben Lean. I'm from District 4A. It's my second term also on higher ed. My district is primarily the city of Moorhead and Oakport Township, just to the north. And like Representative Norton, my district, my community is comprised largely of higher education. I have the two-year, the four-year Minsky campuses, the four-year private nonprofit, a couple of the for-profit schools. So higher ed really is quite a big part of my district, not just for the students in my district, but also for the economic engine and all the folks that are employed through higher education. So very, very looking forward to continuing the work to make tuition as affordable as possible, really getting to the heart of some of the issues with higher education. Certainly we have some new challenges with a lot of the skills gaps and connecting students to the right jobs, to the right training, but also really continuing the path we started last session, holding the systems as accountable as possible. So thank you again, Mr. Chair, and I look forward to the committee's work.
Jason? Are you new to the committee?
Yes, I am new to the committee. Okay. Jason Isaacson in my second term. I represent Little Canada Shoreview, Bad Ness Heights and Roseville and Gem Lake. I did my bachelor's and master's at North Dakota State University, go Bison National Championship four-peat. What up? I'm very excited about that. It was a great game on Saturday. I also am a PhD candidate at the University of Minnesota, and I've been in higher education for about 10 years, teaching everywhere from MCTC and Century College to Johns Hopkins University in George Washington, so a wide breadth of experience in higher education, and I'm very excited to be here and to contribute where I can. Thank you.
I was going to add that even though most of us really could care less about the Bison, we sure enjoyed the football game.
Well, thank you.
And it was about as good as they get. So, Paul.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Paul Rosenthal. I represent District 49B, used to be 41, which is Southern Edina, Western Bloomington, a little bit of Eden Prairie, and a little bit of Minnetonka. It's my third term, second term on this committee. I look forward to this committee a lot. I'm really interested in working toward realigning some of our Minsky system schools with some of our high schools for filling those jobs that are out there today that are going unfilled, such as high-skilled manufacturing jobs, and I'm looking forward to working on the committee. It's always been a pleasure to work with you, and I'm really excited to be here.
Thank you. Connie? That's my sister's name, by the way. So,
excellent name. Is she Connie or Constance?
Boy, that's a good question. Okay. Technically Constance, but we never have ever called her that.
Yeah. Gotcha. Okay, well, thank you. I'm looking forward to serving on this committee. I represent the communities of New Brighton, Fridley, and Spring Lake Park, on top of the Twin Cities, Minneapolis and St. Paul. I'm really looking forward to, I'm really working for this committee because this is part of my history, is our public education system here in Minnesota. I was just jotting down the colleges that my parents and my family have gone to, and it's amazing. It's three different Minsky colleges, two in greater Minnesota, one in the metro area, technical colleges, Hennepin Tech, St. Cloud Tech, and community colleges, Anoka Ramsey, Century College, North Hennepin, and then University of Minnesota, Minneapolis campus, St. Paul campus, Duluth campus, and then also undergraduate and graduate degrees. And the thing I'm most proud of is my parents were teenage parents, and they're still married after like 55 years now. But my mom went back to college when I was about 8 or 9, and she got freshman of the year at Anoka Ramsey. And she got her 2-year nursing degree, and now she later on went and got her master's in nursing. And they were able to retire when they were like 55 or 57 years old, and they did it all on their own. And, you know, they talk about the American dream and how education does that and how back then people were able to do that. And that's what I hope that we can ensure happens to all of our, everyone here in Minnesota, have that opportunity.
Thank you. We're missing one. Maybe he'll be coming late. I have to mention, as a chair of...
I'm sure we'll hear from him.
Oh, will you? Okay. But we'll work him in when the time is right. But when you're chair of the committee, it's really nice to see the committee arrive basically on time and basically everybody be here. And hopefully that'll be our... It's also difficult when it's later in the afternoon like this. This is nap time for some people. So, you know, hopefully not this group. So, no yawning allowed. So, I don't know. We'll let that happen occasionally. Now we probably should hear from some of the other folks. You want to introduce yourself?
Sure. I'm Kaylee Tafe. I'll be the CLA for the committee. I did my undergrad at St. Kate's and my master's at St. Thomas.
I'm Stacy Stout. I'm the CA for the committee. And I'm looking forward to working with all of you and Chairman Nornes.
Down the line.
And Mr. Chair, Matt Gehring from Nonpartisan House Research. Ken Savory, fiscal staff to the committee.
Sean Williams, also from Nonpartisan House Research.
I'm Lauren Sweeney. I'm the GOP research consultant.
Okay. And
Jenny Nash, DFL Research.
Okay. We have a page or two.
Sam?
I'll talk in the mic. I'm Dominique Hudson. This is my first session. I went to the University of Minnesota, got my BA in Sociology of Law and Criminology, and Poli-Sci was my minor, and I'm excited to be here.
Well, good. And Representative Winkler, we're glad to see you, too. We're just
I'm
winding up.
I'm also excited to be here, Mr. Chair.
You've missed some really fabulous introductions, and we need to hear from you so we know who you are officially.
Mr. Chair, my fabulous introduction is that I'm excited to be here back on the Higher Education Committee and representing the fine people of St. Louis Park, Golden Valley, Plymouth, and Medicine Lake.
Great.
You want more from me than that?
That's enough.
Okay.
Most of us talked about our kids, grandkids, dogs, cats, all that sort of stuff.
Mine are probably similar
to you. Okay. All right. Most of you have been through other committees already, so this is kind of sort of just a repeat, but... as you know, going through the chair is the appropriate protocol here. When you have a question or a comment, I don't have to remind you about that. But and also try to get the attention of either the CA or CLA so that they can put you on a list. Same is true when you come in, if you've, for whatever reason, been delayed. Also make sure that they know that you're here so that they can put you on the list so you don't get, you know, demoted, or not a demotion, but you get a red mark for being absent. So we just soon have you all absent. I mean, not absent, but here. The other thing that we will also talk about just a little bit is the rules that you have probably in your packet. I don't think there's anything out of the ordinary in there. You have had a chance to look at them?
Sure.
Representative Grunhagen?
Representative McDonald and I have a conflict today on a joint meeting, but they did just go check in there.
Okay.
Your introduction.
That's excusable. Yeah.
But normally there's not a conflict, but there's
yeah.
a joint meeting.
Yeah, no, I understand. Appreciate you being here first.
Yeah.
And,
well, our priorities were here first.
Yeah, and remember where you sit next time.
Is this, I remember the seat?
Nobody else has an assigned seat but you.
Thank you.
Okay.
It's an honor. Okay. Yeah. Thank
you. So we talked about the being excused. That's important. Cell phones, again, you've heard this in other committees, but although they're very helpful, they're also sometimes a bit of a bother, especially if you leave them on. So we suggest that you keep them on silence during our meetings. And I know it's tempting to also use them during the committee, minimize that as much as you can. So at least for the witnesses, it looks like we're interested in what they're saying. I think that's we need to provide them the courtesy of attention. So again, this is nothing new. Going back to the actual rules, does anybody see anything there that's going to cause a problem? We'll continue with the 24-hour rule as far as amendments and so forth. Yes, Connor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to clarify on number 8, when you talk about amendments, you're talking about substantive amendments 24 hours in advance. Does that mean that amendments that are typed on less than one half side of a legal sheet do not have to have the 24-hour requirement?
I guess that's kind of what we'll have the discretion of whether we enforce that or not.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Did that clarify it for you? Not? Not really. The very last line, I guess, basically states it. Amendments shall be provided to the CA whether it's substantive or not.
Yeah, I see that, Mr. Chair. Above it, it talks about substantive amendments need to be 24 hours. So when I read that last sentence, I'm interpreting it as the ones that aren't substantive, you still want us to get it in to the CA as well, but it's not a 24-hour requirement. That's how I would interpret it?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions or comments? If not, those will be our rules that we'll operate under. I believe at this point we will begin with our overview. And they will step to the table. I'm not sure who's going to begin, but please identify yourself.
Again, for the record, Mr. Chair, my name is Matt Gehring from House Research, and I'm here along with Ken Savory, the fiscal analyst, and Sean Williams, who's my colleague in House Research. We'll be sort of your nonpartisan staff crew for higher ed this session. And I know on behalf of all three of us, we're looking forward to working with all of you, and feel free to let us know if you have questions as we go through session, either on policy issues or fiscal issues or on issues that don't relate to the committee's work but relate to higher ed. We're happy to help out to the extent that we can. So you should have in your committee packet today a copy of the PowerPoint slides we're going to be using. Basically, what we have for you is a presentation that's designed to provide some of the basics of higher education policy and finance in Minnesota with a focus on the specific issues where there's been some opportunities for legislative oversight and some focus on issues where there has been actual legislative oversight in the past. Ken and I will include some comments on policy and fiscal choices that were made by the legislature in the previous two-year session to bring you up to speed on some of the most recent changes to higher ed policy here in the state. And then at the end, Sean will provide some background on some data and trends related to higher education in Minnesota that we think might be useful to your decision-making for the future two-year session as well as beyond into the future. The presentation today is designed to basically be a basic exposure to issues, so it's not a detailed, comprehensive analysis of higher ed policy. But I know in the coming days and weeks, you're going to hear specifically from the systems and from the Office of Higher Ed, and they'll be equipped to give you some sort of real deeper, detailed information about issues affecting their systems or their offices. But as I said, we're here today to kind of expose you to those issues so you're familiar with the types of questions and types of things that they're likely to raise when they testify in front of the committee. So the first section of the presentation is on governance and legislative oversight, and what I'm going to do is focus on the big three systems in Minnesota. The big three are the sort of public systems: the University of Minnesota, Minnesota State Colleges and Universities, which is MinSCU, and the Office of Higher Education. The reason that we're going to focus on those three today is mostly because those are the institutions that you're likely to hear the most from over the course of the session. Now, certainly there's lots of other private institutions and other industries in Minnesota that affect higher ed. That do have interests in higher ed policy and higher ed regulation in the state, but those issues are kind of separate issues and probably are worth a separate presentation at some point in the future if you're interested in that. But for today, we're just going to focus on the public system, so that's the U of M, MinSCU, and the Office of Higher Ed. And we'll just walk through each system in turn. The first is the University of Minnesota. As you all probably know, the University of Minnesota is probably the most high-profile institution in the state. The university was first established in 1851, which means it predates Minnesota statehood and is designated as Minnesota's land-grant university. Being a land-grant university is a special designation based on a federal law that refers to a series of congressional acts from the mid-19th century that granted land or support to each individual state to establish a system of higher education in that state. Part of the condition of being a land-grant university in the state is that the institution does have specific focus requirements. University is required to focus on academic areas beyond classic sort of liberal arts and sort of classical areas of study, and they're required to include a focus on agricultural issues, military sciences, and mechanical arts. And the idea when this land grant act was first established was that these are the areas that would give people actual sort of practical experience and the ability to function as a working class member of society. And so those missions date from the 19th century and still apply to the university today. There are five major campuses in the university system that exist today, the Twin Cities. As you all know, Duluth campus was established in 1947. There's a campus in Morris that was established in 1960. Crookston has a campus that was established in 1966. And most recently, the city of Rochester has a University of Minnesota campus that was established first in 2006. In addition to the big campus centers, there are also a number of agricultural extension research centers throughout the state, mostly located in rural areas. And these agricultural research centers are part of the land grant requirement and exist to conduct basically ag research and experiments in a variety of places in the state. The University of Minnesota is primarily governed by the university charter, as well as some policies and procedures that are adopted by the U of M Board of Regents. There are also some additional requirements contained in state statute in Chapter 137. The university's charter actually, as I said earlier, predates Minnesota statehood, and so the Minnesota Constitution recognizes the existence of the charter. And because of this, the university has what's a sort of a special status that's called constitutional autonomy. Minnesota is one of three states that has a constitutionally autonomous university. Michigan and the University of California are the other systems that have this. Being a constitutionally autonomous university means basically that the university operates kind of like a fourth branch of government, and so there's a limited reach that the legislature and the executive branch have into the operations of the university. Being constitutionally autonomous doesn't place the university above the reach of the law, and it doesn't place them above your reach as legislators with oversight over higher education issues, but it does limit somewhat the ability to regulate particular issues or particular management decisions that the university is making. So what you're likely to see in legislation affecting the university is legislation that doesn't mandate that they take particular actions, but it's legislation that will request that they do a certain thing. And with any luck, the Board of Regents will agree with your request to them, and they'll implement those policies. But at the end of the day, the Board of Regents does have the final policy-making say over the operations of the university. The Board of Regents is a 12-member body. As I said, they're the final sort of policymakers for the university. The Board of Regents serves 6-year staggered terms. There's one regent per congressional district, and then 4 at-large seats, including one student seat on the Board of Regents. Regent selection is an issue area that you're likely to hear quite a bit about in the coming weeks and months. That's because the legislature has final control and decision-making authority over who is elected to serve on the Board of Regents, and there are going to be 5 seats due for election coming in 2015. There's a 3-step process for electing regents at the university, and the procedures are established by the university charter, by Minnesota statute, and by some legislative rules. The first step in the process has already been completed. There's an advisory council called the Regent Candidate Advisory Council that screens candidates for the regents and submits some non-binding recommendations to the legislature. The RCAC Advisory Council completed that process last Thursday, and so they have now officially submitted recommendations to all of you. They recommended 2 candidates for each of the 5 seats that will be up for election. The next step in the process is the part where you all will be more directly involved. There's a requirement of a joint legislative rule that there a committee of the House Higher Education Committee and the Senate Higher Education Committee meet together to review those nominees and potentially to review other potential candidates for the regents. That meeting is required to occur before February 28th of this year. Once the Joint Committee has met and has made recommendations to the legislature for election of regents, there'll be a joint legislative convention, likely sometime in March, and we'll get you more information about that process and how it works as we get closer to those specific dates. In the 2013 and 2014 sessions, there were a number of policy changes that affected the University of Minnesota, including the probably biggest one that people have heard about the most, which is the tuition freeze. So the legislature provided funding in 2013 to freeze tuition at the 2012 level for resident undergraduate students at the U of M, and that freeze applied for both the 2013 and 14 years and the 2014 and 2015 school years. In addition to the tuition freeze, the legislature included some additional data reporting requirements. So when the university provides its budget request to all of you, they're required to include some additional pieces of information to help you make appropriate decisions about funding levels for the university. The types of data that were added included lots of sort of historical numbers and histories of enrollment and uses of expenditures and revenues collected by the university over a 5-year period. This was one of Representative Pawlowski's initiatives that he worked on in 2013 with the Office of the Legislative Auditor, and so this will be the first cycle where you get that additional data as part of their budget request. In addition to the data reporting, in 2013, the legislature enacted a prohibition on the use of state funds for administrator bonuses and other performance-based incentives. So high-ranking officials at the university are no longer allowed to use the funding that you provide to them to pay for bonuses or other incentives for their salaries. Next, the Minnesota Discovery, Research, and Innovation Economy Program was established. This is commonly referred to as MnDrive. When the university comes and presents to you, they'll give you a lot more detail about how the MnDrive program works. Basically, this is a funding initiative that the university had to sort of incentivize research in particular academic areas and to connect that research with industry in the state. And a couple other issues that affect the University of Minnesota that were enacted in policy over the last couple of years, include a request that the university recognize veteran status as a positive factor in admissions and grant resident tuition rates to veterans who've been honorably discharged from the military. And then also a provision in statute related to the use of dogs and cats for research. This is not a provision that's specific to the university, but it does affect them probably more than the other institutions. This requires that when animals are used for research, that they be offered up for adoption once the research is complete, if that's possible. In addition to the policy changes, there are some mandated legislative reports that are going to be coming to you over the next couple of months. Due January 15th, which is this Thursday, you should receive from the University a capital appropriations for asset preservation report. This is a long name for saying a report that tells you about buildings that are falling down and how they're going to fix them. The report is required to include funding projects to fix buildings from 2014 and also give you a priority list of buildings that they'd like to fund using these funds in 2015. On February 1st, you should receive a report from the university that specifies the status and outcomes of some ag and extension research that was funded through a special appropriation in 2014. February 15th, you should get an update from the university on their master academic plan for the metropolitan area. This is a report that's an ongoing report every year that is intended to help the systems, both the U of M and Minsky, collaborate a little bit more and provide a little bit more efficiency, particularly in the metro area, but also statewide. And then finally, March 1st, you should get a report from the university specifically about their MnDrive initiatives and the outcomes of those projects thus far.
Anyone have any questions regarding the university before we move on? Apparently not, so...
Right, Mr. Chair, with that, then I'll move on to MnSKU. MnSKU is a little bit different than the University of Minnesota. The MnSKU is entirely a creature of statute. MnSKU is a system of consolidated public universities, community colleges, and technical colleges. They were consolidated in statute in 1991, and the full merger and implementation of the MnSKU system was complete in 1995. There are 31 MnSKU campus locations in the state, which includes 7 4-year universities and 24 2-year colleges. Their fiscal 2014 enrollment was over 264,000 students statewide. MnSKU is governed primarily by Chapter 136F of statute. You'll hear a lot about that chapter as we move through legislation this session. The system, because it's created in statute, it doesn't have a charter or other constitutional provision as the University of Minnesota does, so it's a little bit easier for you all as legislators to conduct oversight and to regulate their activities because they are entirely created by statute. MnSKU's equivalent of the Board of Regents is called the Board of Trustees. There's a 15-member Board of Trustees that sets system policy. They all serve 6-year staggered terms and have 2-year terms for some student representatives. There's one trustee per congressional district, 3 students on the board, and then one member who's designated to represent labor interests. Unlike the Board of Regents, you don't have any direct control over who is appointed to the trustees. Trustees are appointed by the governor with the advice and consent of the Senate, but there is an entity called the Trustee Candidate Advisory Council that screens candidates and submits non-binding recommendations to the governor, and this Trustee Candidate Advisory Council does include 12 appointees that are made by the Speaker of the House. In reviewing candidates, as I mentioned, there's one designated labor seat on the Board of Trustees, and in that process, the Minnesota AFL-CIO is required by statute to participate in reviewing candidates for that position. And in the student positions, the University and College Student Associations are required to screen candidates and also assist in recommending candidates for that position. There are no current vacancies in the Board of Trustees, although there's one student position whose term is set to expire in June of this year. So the big policy changes for MnSKU from the 2013 and 2014 session includes the tuition freeze. The same tuition freeze that applied to the University of Minnesota applied to MnSKU as well. The same additional data reporting requirements that apply to the University of Minnesota also apply to MnSKU, so you're going to get some additional reporting on 5-year histories of revenues and expenditures from the MnSKU system in this year's budget request. Similarly, MnSKU is prohibited from using state funds to pay for administrator bonuses or other performance-based incentives. They're required to recognize veteran status as a positive factor in admissions and grant resident tuition for veterans. Additionally, MnSKU is required to facilitate an electronic portfolio life and career planning program. This is a program that actually operates across a number of different agencies, but MnSKU is kind of the central agency that works on this. Minsky is also going to come to you with a credit transfer plan. One of the issues that the system has been dealing with fairly regularly is the issue of students who transfer from a two-year program to a four-year program and then have difficulty actually completing their degree because the credits don't transfer appropriately. So they were mandated the last biennium to come to you with specifics on a plan for facilitating that process a little bit better. And finally, the 2013 budget bill required Minsky to convene a summit related to mental health professionals and to come up with plans to better facilitate development of mental health professionals in all areas of the state. Like the University of Minnesota, Minsky is going to come to you with a number of mandated legislative reports this coming year. There's going to be four of them that hopefully you'll see by Thursday. The first one is the Capital Appropriations for Asset Preservation Report. So again, this is the report that's going to tell you tell you about buildings that are in need of maintenance or repair. On Thursday, you should also see a report from Minsky related to their mental health issues summit. There's also a report due on the electronic infrastructure and portfolio solutions plan, and also a report due related to a leverage equipment program. And I think Ken will give you a little more detail about how the leverage equipment program works in his portion of the presentation. On February 15th, you'll hear from Minsky on their master academic plan for the metro area. So this is the report I mentioned earlier that is designed to require the U of M and Minsky to collaborate a little bit better to and be a little more efficient, particularly the metro area academic offerings. February 15th, Minsky is also required to provide a report to you on veterans in graduate and professional programs. March 15th, you'll get a report from Minsky on baccalaureate degree completion issues. And October 1st, you'll get a report related to degree credit caps, which is an ongoing report from a number of years ago. And so, Mr. Chair, those are the two big public systems in the state. I'm next going to move on to the Office of Higher Education, which is not an actual educational institution, but is sort of the administrative agency for higher education in Minnesota. The Office of Higher Education is a cabinet-level state agency, which is directed by the Commissioner of Higher Education. The Commissioner just recently gained that title in the last biennium. He used to be called the Director of Higher Education, and in the on-session bill last session, his title was elevated to Commissioner of Higher Education. The Commissioner is advised by a 6-member Student Advisory Council that is supposed to review issues affecting students and provide advice to the Commissioner and to the Office on issues that are of concern around the state. There are a few major administrative responsibilities that the Office of Higher Education has, including administration of state-based financial aid and grant programs, as well as in some limited circumstances, they administer federal aid programs. The Office of Higher Education also administers and enters into tuition reciprocity agreements. Minnesota has reciprocity agreements with North Dakota, South Dakota, Wisconsin, and Manitoba, and there's also one limited reciprocity agreement with Iowa Lakes Community College and Minnesota West Community and Technical College. The Office of Higher Education also interacts with private systems in the state. They register nonprofit private post-secondary institutions, and they license for-profit career schools in the state. And they also serve as sort of a clearinghouse for data on higher education systems in Minnesota, including data on tuition, enrollment, participation in student aid programs, and other relevant pieces of data that affect institutions and students in the state. A few of the policy changes that affect the Office of Higher Education from 2013 and 2014 include enactment of language related to the statewide longitudinal education data system, which the acronym is SLEDS. This is a big database that maintains data on students from essentially preschool all the way through college and sometimes beyond. It's a major database that is housed within the Office of Higher Education, but it does collect data from a number of different agencies and programs in the state. There's establishment of a high school to college developmental transition program grant system in 2013. A supplemental grant assistance program for tribal colleges was enacted in 2013, and the Office of Higher Education facilitates that program. There are some adjustments to the family and student responsibility amounts for state grant programs. The Prosperity Act, which is also known as the DREAM Act, was enacted in the last biennium. There's additional language related to safety and security of study abroad programs that was enacted in 2014, and the Office of Higher Education works with the Secretary of State's office on that program. And then there's also a new policy that was enacted in 2014 that provides for student loan refinancing, and the office is currently in the process of studying that, and refinancing of student loans is authorized beginning this coming summer. And finally, some mandated legislative reports that you're going to see in 2015 from the Office of Higher Ed include a report by Thursday on the Intervention for College Attendance Program. By January 31st, you'll see a report on the Tuition Reciprocity Program. This is an annual report. By February 1st, you'll get a report on the state regulation of study abroad programs and the student loan refinancing system. February 15th, you'll get some updated state grant spending projections, and March 15th, there'll be a report on the high school to college developmental transition program grant system. And Mr. Chair, that's the end of the presentation, the portion of the presentation on governance and legislative oversight. So if there's any questions on the things I've talked about to this point, I can take those.
Representative Bernardi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question regarding the credit transfer plan. Are we going to be receiving that plan, or is it already completed?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bernardi, the report that you're going to receive is the detailed MNSCU's plan for addressing those issues. I don't know exactly what the content will be. I think there's some I think it may be a combination of sort of internal fixes to make sure the transfer system works appropriately, and I don't know if they'll be proposing legislative changes as well, but that that ideally will be included in the report when it comes to you.
Okay, and Mr. Chair, I was just trying to find out when we're supposed to be receiving that.
Mr. Chair and Representative Bernardi, that report comes on March 15th. It's the baccalaureate degree completion report. It's on slide 13.
Yeah, but that's not what I'm saying. Is it what he's saying? It comes in? Oh, okay.
And again, Mr. Chair, the issue there with that report is that this is addressing concerns that particularly students of two-year institutions have raised within the MNSCU system, that they complete a number of credits at a two-year program, and then they go to transfer to a four-year university in the system, and they find out that a number of their credits from their two-year college don't transfer into the university, and so they find that they're not able to complete their degree in 4 years, that they have to take an extended time to make up for some of the credits that didn't transfer.
I think there's a lot of interest in that report, because that's been an issue for a long time, and hopefully we can maybe improve on that somewhat, maybe not perfect. But any other questions at this? Representative Norton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I might have just missed this, but I recall a couple years ago we put in place some performance measures both for the university and for MNSCU. And I'm wondering, do we get a report on those, or how do we find out if they met those? I think there were five goals for each.
Mr. Chair, Representative Norton, I know Mr. Savory is going to include that in his fiscal portion of the presentation. There were five performance measures for both MNSCU and the University of Minnesota that were enacted as part of the 2013 budget, and the condition was that 5%, I think it was 5%, of their budget appropriation was tied to meeting three of those five performance measures. And I know in the case of the university, they submitted a report to the commissioner of MMB that they had met all five of those performance measures, and MNSCU, I believe, had met three of five, so they both qualified for the additional appropriations.
Representative Norton.
Yeah, and I guess I'll talk with you after and track down those reports, only because it's great that there's a 5% funding for it, but I'd like to know which ones they're doing well and which ones they're not, just beyond them getting the money. So we could talk later. Thank you.
Any other questions? If not, let's proceed. Who is up next?
Mr. Chair and members, again, for the record, my name is Ken Savory of House Fiscal Analysis. When I was constructing these slides the last couple of days, I was trying to make essentially a document that you could take with you over and use over the next several months as a kind of a record of what has happened fiscally in this particular area over the last biennium or so. We'll start with the first slide that just kind of gives a general overview of higher education general fund spending on a biennial basis from the 86-87 biennium to the 2014-2015 biennium. These are merely general fund expenditures. They do not account for rises in student population or changes within the economy. They're merely what is expended by the state to supply our two largest higher education systems, Office of Higher Education and the Mayo Clinic partnership. The next slide is a pie chart of just kind of a breakdown overall of where general fund spending goes within the state. You'll see on the right-hand side that higher education takes up 7.2% of the overall general fund spending for the state. At one point during the late 80s, this was as high as 15.3%, I believe. So it has decreased since then. Going on with that, there is a statute in Section 135A01 that refers to the legislative financing of higher education in the state of Minnesota, which current statute kind of puts down on paper the intent of the legislature to provide 67% of the combined revenue of tuition, the university fee at the University of Minnesota, and the state general fund appropriation to public post-secondary institutions. And just for point of information, the university fee at the University of Minnesota no longer exists, so the statute is a little bit out of alignment. On the next page, you'll see a fiscal overview of the 2013 session. The two places I want to kind of concentrate on are in the two most right-hand columns, which show the percentage increases in appropriation or enacted appropriation for our various accounts within this area. The four accounts being the Office of Higher Education, the Mayo Foundation, MinSKU, and the University of Minnesota. You'll see that the Office of Higher Education received a pretty substantial increase in funding related to the state grant program, and hence why the percentages are so high for the particular area. Additionally, you'll note that in both MinSKU and the University of Minnesota, you'll see single-digit increases. MinSKU nearly 10%, and the University of Minnesota 7%. That was largely the cause of the tuition freeze, research initiatives, and some various other items that we'll go through in a moment.
Representative Barrett has a question at this point. Do you want to go ahead?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Savory. Just wanted to ask a clarifying question on that legislative financing, 67%. I think I missed part of what you said, but did you say that the intent was or is that the state would generate 67% of the funding for the U of M?
Mr. Savory.
Mr. Chair and members, from the way statute is written, it is the intent of the legislature to do that. It is not a requirement of the legislature to do that. There's another statute which states that this funding is to be done within. Essentially, it takes into account the how much money is available from the forecast and how much money is available from the general fund to do so.
Representative Baird.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Savory, does the rest of the money come from tuition? Would that be where the remaining 33% would go?
Mr. Chair and members, that is correct. You'll see a split up between essentially how tuition is funded and that money is given to the institution, and then you'll see the state appropriation fill in the rest of that, the two large components.
And then just one other question. Would it be fair then to say that enrollees, students pay for about a third of the cost of tuition?
Mr. Savory.
Mr. Chair and members, I couldn't say with certainty on that, but I would say that they are paying a significant portion of the of higher education funding.
So then just one more. So then would non-residents then, would it be appropriate for them to pay the full cost? I'm trying to understand the difference between resident tuition and non-resident, and thinking that the state of Minnesota supplements the reduced tuition that residents pay, so then therefore the true cost of tuition or cost of the university would be a lot higher. Wondering about non-residents and if they would pay the full costs or not, generally speaking.
Mr. Savory.
Mr. Chair and members, I believe that question would probably be better directed towards the University of Minnesota and Minsky when they come before the committee. It's my understanding that the University of Minnesota has a strategy in which they try to price non-resident tuition within its certain parameters, and the strategy and how they see look at their enrollment. And I imagine Minsky would have a similar strategy or idea on how they think about non-resident tuition.
Sure. Thank you. Thank you.
Okay. No other questions at this point, so proceed.
So just a little going over the 2013 session for the University of Minnesota. As I mentioned before, and as Mr. Gearing mentioned before, there was a tuition freeze for FY14 and FY15 with a cost of $14.2 million in FY14 and $28.4 million in FY15. And this applied to resident undergraduates. Additionally, there was funding for the MnDRI research program, which Mr. Gearing described, and as one of the members mentioned, a language provision that holds back 5% of the Board of Regents' FY15 appropriation unless certain performance goals are met. Moving on to MnSCU, there was a similar tuition freeze with the cost of $25.5 million in FY14 and $52.5 million for FY15. Additionally, there was $17 million worth of one-time funding to retain high-quality faculty and staff, and then a $7.2 million for a leverage equipment program in FY15 and $14.5 million in FY16 and 17. The leverage equipment program was intended to provide resources to acquire state-of-the-art equipment at colleges and universities on which to train students in areas of high employer need. The program is intended to help colleges and universities build what I'd probably call long-term relationships with private industry and the communities and employers in the area in sectors where employment need is the most great. The way the funding works is that in order to receive the match dollars from the state, funding match from the community or an employer is required in order to receive those funds. So the financial partnership both within MnSCU and within a private employer or the community. Additionally, in 2013, the Office of Higher Education, as I said before, received a significant funding increase for the state grant program. the $74.95 million over the course of the 14-15 biennium was dispersed in a number of areas, what are called formula changes to the state grant program. I know that Office of Higher Ed is coming in this week to go over those, and I'll leave that to them to explain them in more detail, but the statistics are listed on your slides. Additionally, during the 2014 session, there were some adjustments to the three major areas of higher education. You can see them here on the spreadsheet. I'll just go into them in more detail now. MnSCU received a $17 million base increase associated with the settlement of employment contracts. OHE received an additional $750,000 of one-time money to expand the College Possible program. And then you received an additional base increase related to the regenerative medicine partnership with the Mayo Clinic. Additionally, in higher education, there is a component that doesn't necessarily go through this committee, but goes through the Capital Investment Committee. You'll probably most likely hear from the various MnSCU and University of Minnesota presenters about their capital investment or capital plan request to the state. And just for the next couple of slides, I just want to provide a quick overview of what higher education bonding looks like in the state of Minnesota. So typically, much of the dollars are used for HEPR, which stands for Higher Education Asset Preservation and Replacement. Statute defines what HEPR is and what projects are eligible. Additionally, it can only be used for a certain type of project. Examples of that would be things like health and safety code compliance, ADA Act requirements, and hazardous materials abatement. Mm-hmm. Probably the second most common type of bonding you'll hear about in higher education is general obligation bonds or GO bonds. And these are bonds that are security backed by the full faith and credit of the state. And the state will, in fact, levy a property tax if necessary to meet that debt service obligation. Each bond issue must distinctly specify the purposes and maximum amount of proceeds authorized to be expended for each purpose. And three major pillars you have to clear in order for this to be eligible are: must be publicly owned, constitute a capital expenditure, and for a public purpose. And this requires a 60% vote of the legislature in order to move forward with it. And the final type of bond you'll probably hear about will be revenue bonds. These are bonds which are issued debt by both the University of Minnesota and MinSCU, so essentially agency-issued debt. These do not count, because of that, these do not count against the capital investment guidelines, and these principal and interest are paid exclusively by the revenue stream from that particular building or from the institutions. And these are enacted by a simple majority of the legislative body.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Pulaski.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Savory, can you go back just for a second and explain the tuition impact on bonding when we bond and what that tuition impact would be?
Mr. Savory.
Through the debt service.
Mr. Chair and Representative Pulaski, I think the institution would probably be better to describe that to you. I don't have the details with me at this time.
All right, and I think we'll revisit it then. But when the systems say that HEPR is cheaper, when you do a HEPR project, do you have a debt service requirement that would impact tuition? We'll wait for the systems. I'm not going to put you on the spot. But this is one of the issues that does come up, and the curious fact that when we do say something is cheaper, it's cheaper in one way, but the intent of the other way was to cut down on the number of projects, which we have seen do nothing but expand over the same time period. I'll wait for the systems to do it.
Okay. Any other questions before we move on? Mr. Williams, are you next now then? Okay. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sean Williams with House Research. So I'm going to give a sort of very brief, high-level overview of some recent trends and data in the higher education area. Again, I think that for sort of more deeper questions or more detailed questions, it might be wise to wait until either the systems or the Office of Higher Education is before you. So the first thing I wanted to show you is just recent trends in enrollment. So the graph on this slide shows enrollment at four-year colleges and universities in Minnesota. As you can see, MinSCU enrollment is generally higher than either the University of Minnesota or private colleges and university.
Mr. Williams, we have black and white.
Aha.
So can you identify?
Yes.
If we have good eyes, we can also see the screen, but it would help if you just point out which is which.
Sure.
Our black and white version.
The top line is the state colleges and universities system. The sort of middle line that briefly gets crossed in 2011 is the private colleges and universities, and the bottom line is the University of Minnesota system. So as you can see, in general, the state colleges and university system has higher enrollment than either of the other two systems. The other thing you can see is that enrollment peaked for the state colleges and university system and the University of Minnesota in 2011, and it peaked for private colleges and universities in 2010. And some people would attribute that to changes in the economy as the economy has improved. Fewer people are going back to school or are entering school. The other thing you might notice is that MinSCU in general tends to see less variation in enrollment. The other lines are much flatter than for the MinSCU four-year colleges and universities. And that's been an issue in the past in terms of budgeting and finances for the university, for MinSCU. The next slide shows two-year college enrollment, and there's luckily only one line on this slide, so the color won't be an issue for you. But as you can see, enrollment is much higher in two-year colleges and universities. The fall headcount in 2013, which is the most recent data that we had available, was 115,000 students enrolled in two-year colleges and universities, and so that's more than double any of the other three systems I mentioned on the previous slide. And it's slightly less than the other three systems combined. The other thing you see.
Can I hold up for just a minute? We have Isaacson. Representative Isaacson has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Did you mean that Minsky has more variance, not less?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Mr. Chair.
All right, proceed.
So we have, I guess,
another question. Representative Bernardi?
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question about what you said regarding the Minsky system when it talked about a peak and then dropping, and you thought it was attributed to the economy. Can you explain that a little bit more? Do you know that, or is that an analysis that you have some research based on? Because what I'm trying to figure out, the market crashed after 2007. Okay. I guess I have my colleague commenting here for me, but can you just explain a little bit more for me?
Mr. Gehring.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bernardi, that's an issue that I think Minsky will confirm, that they do have higher enrollments when the economy is doing more poorly because more people are going back to school when they don't have access to jobs to be retrained for new jobs. And there is a bit of a lag, I think, in the enrollment numbers and its connection to the way to how healthy the economy is. So it'll take a little while for people that went back to school to complete their degrees, and then once the economy starts to strengthen and get better, you'll see enrollment start to go down because fewer people are enrolling in retraining programs or other programs, and they're actually going into the workforce. And so you'll see once the economy strengthens, sort of gradually numbers will decrease in enrollment, and it particularly affects Minsky programs because they're more technical programs than it does at the University of Minnesota.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Pulaski.
Mr. Chair, might there be another variable, the record increase in tuition and the record increase in debt, and that at simultaneously on your graphs, we have individuals who have encountered debt on a scale we have never seen before, not only in this state but in this country, and also facing the task of 10 to 20 years to pay off that debt. So that's one look at why there's a declining enrollment. But it may also be countered by the fact we have priced out individuals from attending higher education. You don't need to answer the question. We'll wait for the systems to do it. But I think there are many variables in this, and it isn't just the old standard, there's a recession, therefore people go back. During that recession, there were record cuts. There were record increases in tuition. There is now record debt. And I think that variable has to start to be factored in to this scenario.
Williams, you want to continue?
Sure. So, Mr. Chair, member of the committee, I think that's about it. The only thing I would add on the two-year college enrollment graph that I mentioned previously is it looks like relative to the other systems, there does seem to be more variation even in terms of enrollment over time. So the next graph shows that, it's from the Office of Higher Education, it shows that tuition at the University of Minnesota and Minsky four-year and two-year colleges is rising faster than inflation. So this graph shows tuition dollars adjusted for, in 2013, inflation-adjusted dollars. So in all three systems, tuition increased by more than 50% from 2000-2001 to the 2014-15 school year. At the University of Minnesota, it was about a 103% increase in tuition. At Minsky four-year universities, it was a 72% increase. And at Minsky colleges, two-year colleges, it was about a 56% increase in inflation-adjusted tuition over that time. So it's over about 15 years that those increases took place. So this next graph shows sources of financial aid that students are using to pay for tuition. This is from fiscal 13. So, as you can see, this is in Minnesota as a whole. Overall, loans are the largest sources of aid. In 2013, students in Minnesota received about $1,654,000,000 in loans. That's about 52% or 53% of total aid. They also received $1,071,000,000 in grants, and that's about 46.1% of total aid. And finally, they received about $38 million in work study aid, and that's about 1.5% of total aid. As you can see, the federal government is the biggest provider of loans. They gave out about 86.5% of the total loan dollars that Minnesota students received in fiscal 13. And private loans are the next largest chunk. About 10.5% of loan dollars come from private sources. And so on this graph, the top chunk on the right side of the loans bar is private sources of aid, and the bottom chunk is federal. In terms of grants...
Can I just interrupt for just a minute? Representative Rosenthal has a question, I believe.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And if we could go back one slide. I'm just curious as to the huge increase in tuition for the University of Minnesota from 2001 to 2014. Could you also comment on the level of funding that the college received during that time?
Mr. Chair, and members of the committee, I think maybe Mr. Savory could comment on that.
Mr. Savory?
Mr. Chair and members, you can probably categorize over the course of from the 08-09 biennium through about the end of the 13 biennium, higher education funding in the state of Minnesota decreased reasonably substantially from that course. If you look at the graph on slide 19 in your handout, I'd be happy to come back and provide you with some more specifics on that than more of a general overview if you'd like.
Okay. Mr. Williams, back to you.
Sure. So just returning to grants. So the top chunk on the middle bar is grant dollars given out by colleges themselves. So colleges are going to be the largest sources of grant. They give out about 48% of grants to Minnesota students in fiscal 2013. The federal government is the next largest chunk. That's the bottom chunk of that bar graph. And the federal government gave out about 34% of total grant dollars, and the state gave out about 14% of grant dollars in that bar.
Excuse me. There isn't any way to track, for example, M-State, where I happen to represent, has a very substantial scholarship program. So we don't. I assume we don't track the amount of money that is raised and goes to students through those kind of scholarship programs. I'm assuming not all schools have that. But
yeah. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think that sometimes programs like that would be included in the grant funding, and so that's why you're seeing in that second bar colleges themselves being the largest source of those. But I'm not necessarily sure if other sources of scholarship aid would be included. I'd be happy to get back to you if you want to know about this specific detail.
I just know that it's very important to the students, at least in where I live, that's a substantial amount of money that they receive through that program. So, Mr. Williams?
So this graph shows state grant program participation by type of school. So as you can see, the top bars for each of these two schools shows the percentage of the recipients, of the total number of recipients receiving state grant dollars represented by a particular system, whereas the bottom bar represents the percent of dollars that a particular system receives through the state grant program. So as you can see, Minsku two-year programs have the largest number of state grant program recipients, followed by Minsku four-year systems. That's not shouldn't be maybe particularly surprising because they're the two largest systems, as I mentioned on the enrollment chart. As you can see, private, nonprofit, and the University of Minnesota are the largest recipients of state grant program dollars. The private nonprofit schools receive about 27.2%. of state grant program dollars, whereas the University of Minnesota receives about 23% of state grant program dollars. So, we're having some difficulty. So maybe you can just look at your handouts for the next slide. So, the next slide shows sort of average debt levels for graduates in Minnesota. So the top line is the average levels of debt received by students attending private nonprofit four-year schools, whereas the bottom line that sort of crosses over and is slightly higher in the more recent years represents the average debt levels from public four-year schools. This data is from the Institute for College Access and Success, which is an organization that does do some advocacy work, but it's the best source that we're aware of in terms of on the level of student debt. And the other thing I would note is that these sort of numbers are in nominal dollars, so they're not inflation adjusted. But as you can see, nominal average debt amongst graduates of public four-year colleges increased about 26% from 2007-08 academic year to the 2012-13 academic year, whereas nominal average debt among graduates of private nonprofit four-year schools decreased by about 12.3% over that same period.
So, Mr. Chair.
Representative Norton.
So if I'm understanding this correctly, the average debt for private and public are now virtually the same, and more grant dollars are going to the privates than the public, if you look at them individually, on the slide that you had before. Am I understanding that correctly?
Mr. Williams?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, yes. It looks like they're fairly close now in terms of average debt levels of graduates, and that it looks like in terms of total dollars, private nonprofit schools receive more than the University of Minnesota system.
So in other words, if I'm interpreting this correctly, the state is subsidizing our private colleges significantly.
Mr. Williams? Representative Lean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess as a follow-up to that line of questioning, I think it may be beneficial for the committee. This is a comment more than a question. Beneficial for the committee to see, 10, 20-year history on how much funding is going to the public schools in terms of state grant dollars and how much is going to the privates.
Mr. Williams, did you hear the question?
Is there any other questions, Mr. Shea?
No, that was more of a comment.
Just a comment.
Yeah, okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay. Just beneficial for us to see, I think.
Okay. My mistake. Okay, Mr. Williams.
So this graph breaks out the different kinds, more of the different kinds of systems. So this is there's more fine-grained data on the average student loans given out to freshman students. So as you can see, and this is again in nominal dollars, and it only goes through the 2011 and 12 school year, but all four different types of systems represented on this graph have seen increases in average student loans to freshmen who borrowed. So this graph only represents loans given out to students that received, that did borrow. So it would exclude individuals. It doesn't average out individuals that did not borrow. But public four-year colleges saw increases of 12.5% in average student loans. Private nonprofit schools saw decreases of about 0.2% in average loans taken out by students. Public two-year schools saw increases of about 38.3% in average student loans, and private for-profit schools saw increases of about 96% in terms of average student loans given out to freshmen.
I think we need a clarification.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Isaacson.
You skipped the percentages, and maybe I missed it, but which is which on here? I can't tell. Again, the color. We don't show it up in the board, so.
So the line that is at the top in 2007-08, 7,000, that would be private nonprofit schools. The one immediately below it, that's the second one in 2007-08, is public four-year schools. The line in sort of the middle is public two-year schools, and the line at the bottom is private for-profit schools. This final graph. And this is the last slide in my presentation. It shows the tuition reciprocity program. So this is just sort of an overview of where students are going. So as you can see, both the number of students leaving Minnesota in fall 2012 and entering Minnesota as part of the tuition reciprocity program was greatest from to and from Wisconsin. It was next largest to and from North Dakota, and third largest to and from South Dakota. And you can also see for all three states, there are more students leaving Minnesota as part of the tuition reciprocity program than there are entering the state. So that pretty much wraps up our presentation. I'd be happy to answer any other questions. But this is our contact information.
Thank you very much. Yep. Reciprocity will be another conversation we'll have in another time. Yeah, Representative Barrett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Not really a question, but a comment. Appreciate the information. Good stuff here. A lot to digest. I think as we look at tuition and other costs, financial aid, ability of private to your colleges for you to do the things they do, you have to look at the cost structure at the universities or at the colleges. And we didn't have any information here, so it's hard to really get, make too many conclusions based on the fact that I wouldn't know whether a private nonprofit college, generally speaking, are doing better or worse in controlling their overhead and their other costs of doing business than the U of M might or Mankato State or whatever. So I don't know if you would have that information, but I think it would be good information to look at if it's even available, given the fact they're nonprofits and maybe might not have that information available. But certainly looking at the cost structure at the different universities does impact some of the trends that we see here in these documents. Word for the wise.
All right. No questions. So thank you very much, the three of you, for... Oh, Representative Liam.
Thank you. And I just taking a look at one more slide here. I think it would be also beneficial to take a look at some history. Like I said, I don't know, we have to go back 20 years, but the last 10 years on the financial aid sources, your slide 35 there. Thank you.
Yeah, I think we're...
Mr. Chair.
You want a response back?
No.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Representative Pawlowski. Yeah,
Mr. Chair, I think next time, particularly when it's in color, if they send us the digital version, we could view it much easier on an iPad or almost anything else rather than trying to see it in black and white. It is difficult in black and white. Yeah. So if they just send it to us, and it would maybe save on the bulk and these things too.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think we'd also be happy to provide you with electronic copies of our presentation today as well. I think that sounds like it would be helpful.
Okay, very good. Again, thank you very much for this information. It's a good start. And look forward to our next hearing tomorrow. Same place, same time, I guess. So with that, we are adjourned for the day.